Time's pressing on, so we'll just move straight in. Our first speaker is Professor Kenneth Alwig, who's a member of the board of Landscape Research Group. He's a geographer and a philologist. His interests include different concepts of law, different concepts of landscape, and the consequences of this for landscape justice. He's originally from the United States, and he's had a career which has taken him to Washington, D.C., Leeds, Nevis, Stockholm, Trondheim, now living in Copenhagen, and is a professor in the Department of Landscape Planning at the Swedish Life Sciences University in Lund, in Sweden. He's been a director of Landscape Research Group since 2005 and also an associate editor of the journal in his time. So, Ken, can I invite you to come up and give us your thoughts on these questions?
It's supposed to be made big.
Oh. And if you go to view.
View?
Yes, please.
View.
Yeah.
And now full screen.
Full screen. Yeah. That's it.
Thank
beautiful.
You.
Wonderful. Okay. Montesquieu wrote this in the spirit of the laws. The great prerogative of Scandinavia and what ought to recommend its inhabitants is that they afforded the great resource to the liberty of Europe. I should call it the forge of those instruments which broke the fetters manufactured in the south. It was there those valiant nations were bred who left their native climes to destroy tyrants and slaves and to teach men that nature having made them equal, no reason could be assigned for their becoming dependent, but their mutual happiness. We like that in Scandinavia. Montesquieu was inspired to write his influential treatise by both historical sources and a visit to England and its landscape. He saw the English constitution as being ultimately an inheritance from its Scandinavian settlers. His reference to the overthrow of the Roman Empire can be seen as a discreet reference to the need to overthrow contemporary French despotism and strengthen Parliament and the judiciary, much as the English had done. And his book was banned in absolutist France. He became a major source of inspiration for what has become our present-day ideal of just democratic governance. He was opposed to despotism and for the separation of powers between the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. This is what he's perhaps most famous for. And tyrants today have problems with this, tyrants like Trump. Yeah. The political landscape. Montesquieu pioneered the idea that there was an anthropological link between the geographical landscape and the political legal landscape. It was thus the Scandinavians carving out of fields and meadows from wild, dank, cold forests that in his mind created a cultural landscape with a changed, ameliorated climate suitable for cultivation and animal husbandry. So he was interested in climate change and the human impact on it already then. It also, however, helped produce a landscape of dispersed, independent yeoman farmers living within a wooded common landscape requiring common governance. Thus is born the representative institutions which eventually brought parliamentary democracy to England. Montesquieu's narrative, which built on earlier sources, was later used to explain how the English pilgrims brought representative institutions to New England. It also inspired Jeffersonian democracy, which sought to avoid the concentration of property in the hands of large feudalistic landholders. Part one is a Scandinavian example of the influence of Montesquieuian ideas of landscape justice, in which the natural landscape ideal is one of a fertile reciprocal relation between society and its environments. So, and this follows Simon Schama's statement that landscapes are culture, politics, law, and practice before they are nature. They're constructs of the imagination and practice projected onto wood, water, and rock. Much of Sweden's landscape has long retained the character admired by Montesquieu. But by the late 1700s, Denmark had become largely denuded of woodland agriculture, particularly on the heaths of Jutland, Denmark. You can see how much heath is on the black stuff. The Jutland author Steen Steensen Blicher helped initiate a Danish landscape research tradition using place name and archaeological evidence to show that the heaths had previously been wooded and more intensively cultivated. But the land had experienced desertification due to war and economic and social marginalization. Blicher argued that it was a national duty to restore the landscape for the sake of people living there, a forerunner of the modern environmental justice movement. Blicher thereby helped initiate a campaign to restore the heaths to their previous cultivated and wooded state while preserving heathlands where most appropriate. You can see that some heath is left, but much of it is gone. Denmark in Blicher's day was an absolute monarchy, but Blicher argued that landscape evidence, such as the presence of places named ting, meaning thing or moot, showed that there had previously been a more representative form of governments, and he campaigned for its reinstatement by promoting popular meetings in the Jutland landscape. The role of the Tinghøj, or the Thing place, in the landscape is illustrated by the naming of the restored Danish parliament, the Folketing. It's called Christiansborg. If you've been watching the TV series Borgen, that's where it comes from. Part two is the flip side of Montesquieu. This is when wild nature determines culture. And to this, Simon Sharma's statement, continuation of his statement, helps explain the problem. But it should also be acknowledged that once a certain idea of landscape, a myth, a vision, establishes itself in an actual place, it has a peculiar way of muddling categories, of making metaphors more real than their reference, of becoming, in fact, part of the scenery. The late 1700s saw the rise of what might be called a cult of the wild as depicted in the wild Highland Scottish landscape of the newly discovered epic poetry, as was in a way a fabrication, epic poetry of the supposed ancient 3rd century bard Ossian. Bits and pieces of it were genuine, but it was put into a larger framework, which was not Ossian. Ossian's nation was linked to the Scandinavians, but they were individualistic hunter warriors and not agriculturalists like Montesquieu's. According to James McPherson, who ghost wrote the Ossian epics, it was a weaker, perhaps Celtic or Celtic race of agriculturalists who supplanted Ossian's heroic warriors. Echoing Tacitus, Tacitus Germania, he wrote, "Their language is pure and original, and their manners are those of an ancient and unmixed race of men. Conscious of their own antiquity, they long despised others as a new and mixed people." Here again, he's probably referring to the Celts. "And some saw the Jutland heaths in this Ossianic light." McPherson belonged to a circle of intellectuals surrounding Adam Smith, who was professor of Belles Lettres before he founded liberal economic theory. This circle believed language originated in its purest form as a poetic expression amongst individualistic primitive people who provided the model for Smith's ideal of economic man. So it was both a reactionary thing, going back to this primitiveness, and a modern thing, the modern idea of liberal economics, a kind of double think. Karl Marx saw this and wrote of the economic liberal's ideal that this 18th century individual appears as an ideal whose existence they project into the past, not as a historic result, but as history's point of departure, as the natural individual appropriate to their notion of human nature, not arising historically, but posited by nature. So whereas the reciprocal agrarian ideals of Montesquieu celebrates a natural landscape mediated by a natural reciprocal symbiosis between people and their environs, the economic liberal's naturally rugged individual could be both an ancient warrior, hunter bard, or a modern industrialist or sheep rancher, because they extract their raw materials from an uncultivated nature. Again, this kind of thing. Sheep ranching, of course, when you have large numbers of sheep, they eat men, man-eating sheep, if you haven't heard of them. McPherson himself helped create an empty, rewilded landscape by clearing his Highland estates of its crofters. As one historian writes, "Mr. James McPherson of Ossianic fame began this wretched business. Every place James McPherson acquired was cleared, and he also had a craze for changing and obliterating the old names, including changing rates into Belleville, the name of his estate." So he praises this wild landscape in the Ossian epics and then creates it, and in a way justifies doing what he did by clearing the place. Blicher himself was initially attracted to Ossian, but changed his mind, influenced partly by Sir Walter Scott, who in 1816 wrote of the clearances, "In too many instances, the glens of the highlands have been drained, not of their superfluity of population, but of the whole mass of the inhabitants, dispossessed by an unrelenting avarice, which will one day be found to have been as unwise as it is unjust and selfish. Meanwhile, the highlands may become the fairy ground for romance and poetry, the subject of experiment for professors of speculation, political and economical." Napoleon, however, literally embraced Ossian. This is a painting showing Ossian welcoming Napoleon's generals into the heavens. Ossian was also hugely popular amongst German and Scandinavian national romantics, who saw him as an ancestral figure who for some belonged to a Nordic race superior to the Celts and the Slavs. You might be wondering about all the red hair, but that was because Tacitus claimed that the German, or the Nordic people all had red hair. And the women went topless, as they're doing there. This was about the same time that the German Nordic artist Caspar David Friedrich was painting scenes of wild Nordic-inspired landscape, similar to that described by Ossian. He studied painting in Copenhagen under Abildgaard, a Dane famous for his Ossian Nordic painting. So this painting is by Abildgaard, and that's Caspar David, his most famous painting. Friedrich later became a darling of the Nazis, who saw the wild Nordic landscape as determining the freedom-loving and pure character of the Teutonic race, and who saw the Jews and Slavs as adulterated races hindering modern progress. Some English and American nationalists similarly saw white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, WASPs, as being racially superior to the Catholic Celts, the Africans, and the Jews. Adolf supposedly means Athelwolf, meaning the noble wolf, and that's his eagle's nest. One bizarre illustration of the landscape just as consequences of the Nazi wilderness nature ideal took place in the Białowieża forest, not long the hunting estate of foreign royalty. So even though it was located in Poland and Belarus, often the people who, the royalty that used the forest were from elsewhere. So this is what it looked like at that time. After the Nazis occupied Poland, Hermann Göring sought to rewild the landscape by creating a kind of Nazi Jurassic Park, with both backbred versions of the extinct wild animals like the auroch, but also wolves and buffalo. This also meant cleansing the landscape of people, and in 3 years they cleared 20,000 people, including a large Jewish population, who they later executed on the spot or sent off to concentration camps. So it was both modern, because he's backbreeding and recreating ancient animals, but it's also obviously very reactionary. There you see a Nazi cow down there. Today, the forest is an international environmentalist cause celebre because the Polish foresters want to manage it, and environmentalists want it left untouched. Is this landscape justice or injustice? This is a hot topic right now. It's called, by the UNESCO, one of Europe's last virgin forests, but as I showed you, it wasn't at all that virgin because it was used as a hunting ground for centuries. There was an American precedent for Białowieża. Frederick Law Olmsted, the landscape architect, wrote, he did a study of the Yosemite before it became a national park, and he wrote in that study, "The power of scenery to affect men is in a large way proportionate to the degree of their civilization and to the degree in which their taste has been cultivated. Among 1,000 savages, there will be a much smaller number who will show the least sign of being so affected than amongst 1,000 persons taken from a civilized community." Now, Olmsted actually hated the Indians more than he hated the Irish, which was saying much. But anyway, the fighting, he writes, "The fighting Indian met with on the frontier is the antitype and the natural enemy of the civilized man. According to the civilized standard, he is lazy, ravenous, brutal, filthy, improvident, lying, treacherous, bloodthirsty scoundrel." Can't get much worse than that. The Yosemite Indians, or the Native Americans, were expelled from Yosemite, the Yosemite Valley, and many of them were massacred. Central Park is also a Olmsted product. More recently, several thousand largely Scotch-Irish, as they're called in America, homesteaders were cleared to create wilderness in the Shenandoah National Park in Virginia. And this was judged to be okay because, according to modern science, these hillbillies were inbred and thus genetically inferior. A contemporary conflict can be seen at Hawswater in the Lake District, where a dam and water reservoir for industrial Manchester drowned Mardale Village in the early 20th century, helping to prompt the British environmental movement. Now United Utilities is rewilding much of the remaining pasture and turning it into an RSPB, Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, nature reserve that attracts birders to see England's last golden eagle and, incidentally, stay at the hotel, but which also has provoked bitter criticism from the shepherding community. So my point of this is that the relationship between landscape justice and injustice is complex. It involves difficult questions of interpretation and judgment that demands landscape research. I could point out that, for example, Vera, Franz Vera, in his Grazing Ecology and Forest History, has done recently done a study of Bielowice where he says that it never was dense forest, ever. And he shows has got a lot of information to show that. So that's one kind of research, the kind of research Blicker also did. What was the place actually like? Simon Schama is Jewish and his family comes actually from this Bielowice area. So he has written a very, very fascinating book called Landscape and Memory, which takes its departure in what happened to the, particularly the Jewish population in that area. My book, Nature's Ideological Landscape, tells the story of Blicker and the Jutland Heaths, if you're interested. My more recent book, Landscape, Nature, and the Body Politic, goes into some of the issues of racism and so on that I've touched on. The book, Uncommon Ground, is a very influential study which has taken on this kind of wilderness mystique and argued and had a huge influence on changing the minds of conservationists with regard to nature preservation. There's much more openness now to allowing human beings to interact with landscapes to create biodiversity because it tends to disappear if the land is just allowed to go to pot. Because of the present-day political climate, there's a rising interest in Nazism and that sort of thing. Georges Monbiot, I think in the most recent edition of his book, Feral, has a whole chapter called The Brute Within, where he discusses the connection to Nazism, but also to what you could call land grabbing in the Third World, where local populations lose their commons in order to create forests, which will then stop the amount of CO2 in the environment. But they are doing this to help countries like Norway that are producing too much. So it's an unfair kind of thing. Uneven development. Neil Smith, a Scot, wrote a book about the way that Scotland was turned into nature, and kind of things I was talking about. There's a book, The Right to Landscape, Contesting Landscape and Human Rights, which is very pertinent to this whole, two editors are here, so you can speak to them later. Yeah, so that's what I have to say.
Happening.
Thank you, Ken. If you don't mind, I think because we started a bit behind time, I'd maybe like to just continue with the speakers and we can get everyone up for a general kind of question and answer discussion at the end, so rather than take questions immediately, Ken, but thank you for that. There's a lot to talk about there.